course, our version of Yonkers at Incheon, and all of it, compounded by the need to keep at least half our active divisions along our northern border. Too many in the Ministry of National Defense were convinced that the Pyongyang was just aching for war, waiting eagerly for our darkest moment to come thundering across the 38th parallel. We in the intelligence community couldn't disagree more. We kept telling them that if they were waiting for our darkest hour, then that hour had most certainly arrived. Daehanminguk was on the brink of national collapse. Plans were being secretly drafted for a Japanese-style resettlement. Covert teams were already scouting locations in Kamchatka. If the Chang Doctrine hadn't worked, if just a few more units had broken, if a few more safe zones had collapsed, maybe we owe our survival to the North, or at least to the fear of it. My generation never really saw the North as a threat. I'm speaking of the civilians, you understand? Those of my age who saw them as a backward, starving, failed nation. My generation had grown up their entire lives in peace and prosperity. The only thing they feared was a German-style reunification that would bring millions of homeless ex-communists looking for a handout. That wasn't the case with those who came before us. Our parents and grandparents, those who lived with the very real specter of invasion hanging over them. The knowledge that at any moment the alarms might sound, the lights might dim, and the bankers, school teachers, and taxi drivers might be called to pick up arms and fight to defend their homeland. Their hearts and minds were ever vigilant, and in the end, it was them, not us, who rallied the national spirit. I'm still pushing for an expedition to the north. I'm still blocked at every turn. There's much work to do, they tell me. The country is still in shambles. We also have our international commitments. Most importantly, the repatriation of our refugees to Kyushu. Those Japs are gonna owe us big time. I'm not asking for a recon in force. Just give me one helicopter, one fishing boat. Just open the gates at Panmunjom and let me walk through on foot. What if you trigger some booby trap, they counter? What if it's nuclear? What if you open the door to some underground city and 23 million zombies come spewing out? Their arguments aren't without merit. We know the DMZ is heavily mined. Last month, a cargo plane nearing their airspace was fired on by a surface-to-air missile. The launcher was an automated model, the type they designed as a revenge weapon in case the population had already been obliterated. Conventional wisdom is that they must have evacuated to their subterranean complexes. If that is true, then our estimates of the size and depth of those complexes were grossly inaccurate. Maybe the entire population is underground, tooling away on endless war projects while their great leader continues to anesthetize himself with Western liquor and American pornography. Do they even know the war is over? Have their leaders lied to them again and told them that the world as they know it has ceased to be? Maybe the rise of the dead was a good thing in their eyes. An excuse to tighten the yoke even further in a society built on blind subjugation. The great leader always wanted to be a living god. And now, as master, not only of the food his people eat, the air they breathe, but the very light of their artificial suns. Maybe his twisted fantasy has finally become a reality. Maybe that was the original plan, but something went disastrously wrong. Look what happened to the mole city underneath Paris. What if that occurred in the north on a national level? Maybe those caverns are teeming with 23 million zombies, emaciated automatons, howling in the darkness, and just waiting to be unleashed.
Kyoto, Japan. The old photo of Kondo Tatsumi shows a skinny, acne-faced teenager with dull red eyes and bleached blonde highlights streaking his unkempt hair. The man I am speaking to has no hair at all. Clean-shaven, tanned and toned, his clear, sharp gaze never leaves mine. Although his manner is cordial and his mood light, this warrior monk retains the composure of a predatory animal at rest.
I was an otaku. I know that term has come to mean a great many things to great many people, but for me, it simply meant outsider. I know Americans, especially young ones, must feel trapped by societal pressure. All humans do. However, if I understand your culture correctly, individualism is something to be encouraged. You revere the rebel, the rogue, those who stand proudly apart from the masses. For you, individuality is a badge of honor. For us, it is a ribbon of shame. We lived, particularly before the war, in a complex and seemingly infinite labyrinth of external judgments. Your appearance, your speech, everything from the career you held to the way you sneeze had to be planned and orchestrated to follow rigid Confucian doctrine. Some either have the strength, or lack thereof, to accept this doctrine. Others, like myself, chose exile in a better world. That world was cyberspace. And it was tailor-made for Japanese otaku. I can't speak for your educational system, or, indeed, for that of any other country. But ours was based almost entirely on fact retention. From the day we first set foot in a classroom, pre-war Japanese children were injected with volumes upon volumes of facts and figures that had no practical application in our lives. These facts had no moral component, no social context, no human connection to the outside world. They had no reason for existence other than that their mastery allows ascension. Pre-war Japanese children were not taught to think. We were taught to memorize. You can understand how this education would easily lend itself to an existence in cyberspace. In a world of information without context, where status was determined on its acquisition and possession, those of my generation could rule like gods. I was a sensei, master over all I surveyed, be it discovering the blood type of the Prime Minister's cabinet, or the tax receipts of Matsumoto and Hamada, or the location and condition of all Shingunto swords of the Pacific War. I didn't have to worry about my appearance, or my social etiquette, my grades, or my prospects for the future. No one could judge me. No one could hurt me. In this world, I was powerful, and more importantly, I was safe. When the crisis reached Japan, my clique, as with all the others, forgot our previous obsessions and devoted our energies entirely to the living dead. We studied their physiology, behavior, weaknesses, and the global response to their attack upon humanity. The last subject was my clique's specialty: the possibility of containment within the Japanese home islands. I collected population statistics, transport networks, police doctrine. I memorized everything from the size of the Japanese merchant fleet to how many rounds the Army's Type 89 assault rifle held. No fact was too small or obscure. We were on a mission. We barely slept. When school was eventually canceled, it gave us the ability to be wired in almost 24 hours a day. I was the first to hack into Dr. Komatsu's personal hard drive and read the raw data a full week before he presented his findings to the Diet. This was a coup. It further elevated my status among those who already worshipped me.
Dr. Komatsu first recommended the evacuation.
He did. Like us, he'd been compiling the same facts. But whereas we'd been memorizing them, he'd been analyzing them. Japan was an overcrowded nation. 128 million people jammed into less than 370,000 square kilometers of either mountainous or over-urbanized islands. Japan's low crime rate gave it one of the relatively smallest and most lightly armed police forces in the industrialized world. Japan was pretty much also a demilitarized state. Because of American protection, our self-defense forces had not seen actual combat since 1945. Even those token troops who were deployed to the Gulf almost never saw any serious action and spent most of their occupation duty within the protected walls of their isolated compound. We had access to all these bits of information, but not the wherewithal to see where they were pointing. So it took us all by complete surprise when Dr. Komatsu publicly declared that the situation was hopeless and that Japan had to be immediately evacuated.
That must have been terrifying.
Not at all. It set off an explosion of frenzy activity, a race to discover where our population might resettle. Would it be the South, the coral atolls of the Central and South Pacific? Or would we head north, colonizing the Kuriles, Sakhalin, or maybe somewhere in Siberia? Whoever could uncover the answer would be the greatest otaku in cyber history.
And there was no concern for your personal safety?
Of course not. Japan was doomed. But I didn't live in Japan. I live in a world of free-floating information. The Siafu, that's what we were calling the infected now, weren't something to be feared. They were something to be studied. You have no idea the kind of disconnect I was suffering. My culture, my upbringing, and now my otaku lifestyle all combined to completely insulate me. Japan might be evacuated. Japan might be destroyed. And I would watch it all happen from the safety of my digital mountaintop.
What about your parents?
What about them? We lived in the same apartment, but I never really conversed with them. I'm sure they thought I was studying. Even when school closed, I told them I still had to prepare for exams. They never questioned it. My father and I rarely spoke. In the mornings, my mother would leave a breakfast tray at my door. At night, she would leave dinner. The first time she didn't leave a tray, I thought nothing of it. I woke up that morning, as I always did, gratified myself, as I always did, logged on, as I always did. It was midday before I started to feel hungry. I hated those feelings. Hunger or fatigue or, the worst, sexual desire. Those were physical distractions. They annoyed me. I reluctantly turned away from my computer and opened my bedroom door. No food. I called for my mother. No answer. I went into the kitchen area, grabbed some raw ramen, and ran back to my desk. I did it again that night, and again the next morning.
You never questioned where your parents were?
The only reason I cared was because of the precious minutes I was wasting having to feed myself. In my world, too many exciting things were happening.
What about the other otaku? Didn't they discuss their fears?
We shared facts, not feelings. Even when they started to disappear. I'd noticed that someone had stopped returning email or else hadn't posted for a while. I'd see that they hadn't logged on in a day or that their servers were no longer active.
And that didn't scare you?
It annoyed me. Not only was I losing a source of information, I was losing potential praise for my own. To post some new factoid about Japanese evacuation force and to have 50 instead of 60 responses was upsetting. Then to have those 50 drop to 45, then to 30.
How long did this go on for?
About 3 days. The last post, from another otaku in Sendai, stated that the dead were now flowing out of Tohoku University Hospital in the same cho as his apartment.
And that didn't worry you?
Why should it? I was too busy trying to learn all I could about the evacuation process. How was it going to be executed? What government organizations were involved? Would the camps be in Kamchatka or Sakhalin or both? And what was this I was reading about the rash of suicides that was sweeping the country? So many questions. So much data to mine. I cursed myself for having to go to sleep that night. When I woke up, The screen was blank. I tried to sign on. Nothing. I tried rebooting. Nothing. I noticed that I was on backup battery. Not a problem. I had enough reserve power for 10 hours at full use. I also noticed that my signal strength was zero. I couldn't believe it. Kokura, like all Japan, had a state-of-the-art wireless network that was supposed to be fail-safe. One server might go down, maybe even a few, but the whole net? I realized it must be my computer. It had to be. I got on my laptop and tried to sign on. No signal. I cursed and got up to tell my parents that I had to use the desktop. They still weren't home. Frustrated, I tried to pick up the phone to call my mother's cell. It was cordless, dependent on the wall power. I tried my cell. I got no reception.
Do you know what happened to them?
No. Even to this day, I have no idea. I know they didn't abandon me. I'm sure of it. Maybe my father was caught out at work. My mother trapped while trying to go grocery shopping. They could have been lost together, going to or coming back from the relocation office. Anything could have happened. There was no note, nothing. I've been trying to find out ever since. I went back into my parents' room just to make sure they weren't there. I tried the phones again. It wasn't bad yet. I was still in control. I tried to go back online. Isn't that funny? All I could think about was trying to escape again, getting back to my world, being safe. Nothing. I started to panic. Now, I started to say, trying to command my computer by force of will. Now. 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 Now! I started beating the monitor. My knuckles split. The sight of my own blood terrified me. I never played sports as a child, never been injured. It was all too much. I picked up the monitor and threw it against the wall. I was crying like a baby, shouting, hyperventilating. I started to retch and vomited all over the floor. I got up and staggered to the front door. I don't know what I was looking for, just that I had to get out. I opened the door and stared into darkness.
Did you try knocking at the neighbor's door?
No. Isn't that odd? Even at the height of my breakdown, my social anxiety was so great that actually risking personal contact was still taboo. I took a few steps, slipped, and fell into something soft. It was cold and slimy, all over my hands, my clothes. It stank. The whole hallway stank. I suddenly became aware of a low, steady, scraping noise, like something was dragging itself across the hallway toward me. I called out, "Hello?" I heard a soft, gurgling groan. My eyes were just beginning to adjust to the darkness. I began to make out a shape, large, humanoid, crawling on its belly. I sat there paralyzed, wanting to run, but at the same time wanting to know for sure. My doorway was casting a narrow rectangle of dim gray light against the far wall. As the thing moved into that light, I finally saw its face. Perfectly intact, perfectly human. Except for the right eye that hung by the stem. The left eye was locked on mine, and its gurgling moan became a choked rasp. I jumped to my feet, sprang back inside my apartment, and slammed the door behind me. My mind was finally clear, maybe for the first time in years, and I suddenly realized that I could smell smoke and hear faint screams. I went over to the window and threw the curtains open. Kokura was engulfed in hell. The fires, the wreckage, the siafu were everywhere. I watched them crash through doors, invade apartments, devour people cowering in corners or on balconies. I watched people leap to their death or break their legs and spines. They lay on the pavement, unable to move, wailing in agony as the dead closed in around them. One man in the apartment directly across from me tried to fight them off with a golf club. It bent harmlessly around the zombie's head before five others pulled him to the floor. Then, a pounding at the door. My door. This. Boom, 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 boom. From the bottom, near the floor. I heard the thing groaning outside. I heard other noises, too, from the other apartments. These were my neighbors, the people I'd always tried to avoid, whose faces and names I could barely remember. They were screaming, pleading, struggling, and sobbing. I heard one voice, either a young woman or a child on the floor above me, calling someone by name, begging them to stop. But the voice was swallowed in a chorus of moans. The banging at my door became louder. More Xiafu had shown up. I tried to move the living room furniture against the door. It was a waste of effort. Our apartment was, by your standards, pretty bare. The door began to crack. I could see its hinges straining. I figured I had maybe a few minutes to escape.
Escape? But if the door was jammed?
Out the window, onto the balcony of the apartment below. I thought I could tie bedsheets into a rope. I'd heard about it from an otaku who studied American prison breaks. It would be the first time I ever applied any of my archive knowledge. Fortunately, the linen held. I climbed out of my apartment and started to lower myself down to the apartment below. Immediately, my muscles started cramping. I never paid much attention to them, and now they were reaping their revenge. I struggled to control my motions and to not think about the fact that I was 19 floors up. The wind was terrible, hot and dry from all the fires. A gust picked me up and slammed me against the side of the building. I bounced off the concrete and almost lost my grip. I could feel the bottom of my feet bumping against the balcony's railing, and it took all the courage I had to relax enough to climb down just those few extra feet. I landed on my ass, panting and coughing from the smoke. I could hear sounds from my apartment above, the dead that had broken through the front door. I looked up at my balcony and saw ahead. The one-eyed Xiafu was squeezing himself through the opening between the rail and the balcony floor. It hung there for a moment, half out, half in, then gave another lurch towards me and slid over the side. I'll never forget that it was still reaching for me as it fell. This nightmare flash of it suspended in midair, arms out, hanging eyeball now flying upward against his forehead. I could hear the other Xiafu groaning on the balcony above and turned to see if there were any in this apartment with me. Fortunately, I saw that the front door had been barricaded like mine. However, unlike mine, there weren't any sounds of attackers outside. I was also comforted by the layer of ash on the carpet. It was deep and unbroken, telling me that no one or nothing had walked across this floor for a couple days. For a moment, I thought I might be alone. And then I noticed the smell. I slid the bathroom door open and was blown back by this invisible, putrid cloud. The woman was in her tub. She had slit her wrists, long vertical slices along the arteries, to make sure the job was done right. Her name was Reiko. She was the only neighbor I'd made any effort to know. She was a high-priced hostess at a club for foreign businessmen. I'd always fantasized about what she'd look like naked. Now I knew. Strangely enough, what bothered me most was that I didn't know any prayers for the dead. I'd forgotten what my grandparents had tried to teach me as a little kid, rejected it as obsolete data. It was a shame how out of touch I was with my heritage. All I could do was stand there like an idiot and whisper an awkward apology for taking some of her sheets.
Her sheets?
For more rope. I knew I couldn't stay there for very long. Besides the health hazard of a dead body, there was no telling when the Xiafu on that floor would sense my presence and attack the barricade. I had to get out of this building, get out of the city, and hopefully try to find a way to get out of Japan. I didn't have a fully thought-out plan yet. I just knew I had to keep going, one floor at a time, until I reached the street. I figured stopping at a few of the apartments would give me a chance to gather supplies and as dangerous as my sheet-rope method was, it couldn't be any worse than the Xiafu that would almost certainly be lurking in the building's hallways and stairwells.
Wouldn't it be more dangerous once you reach the streets?
No, safer.
He catches my expression.
No, honestly. That was one of the things I learned online. The living dead were slow and easy to outrun or even outwalk. Indoors, I might run the risk of being trapped in some narrow choke point, but out in the open, I had infinite options. Better still, I learned from online survivor reports that the chaos of a full-blown outbreak could actually work to one's advantage. With so many other frightened, disorganized humans to distract the Xiafu, why would they even notice me? As long as I watched my step, kept up a brisk pace, and didn't have the misfortune to be hit by a fleeing motorist or stray bullet, I figured I had a pretty good chance of navigating my way through the chaos on the streets below. The real problem was getting there. It took me 3 days to make it all the way down to the ground floor. This was partially due to my disgraceful physical stamina. A trained athlete would have found my makeshift rope antics a challenge, so you can imagine what they were for me. In retrospect, it's a miracle I didn't plunge to my death or succumb to infection with all the scrapes and scratches I endured. My body was held together with adrenaline and pain medication. I was exhausted, nervous, horribly sleep-deprived. I couldn't rest in the conventional sense. Once it got dark, I would move everything I could against the door, then sit in a corner, crying, nursing my wounds, and cursing my frailty until the sky began to lighten. I did manage to close my eyes one night, even drift off to sleep for a few minutes. But then the banging of a Xiafu against the front door sent me scurrying out the window. I spent the remainder of that night huddled on the balcony of the next apartment. Its sliding glass door was locked, and I just didn't have the strength to kick it in. My second delay was mental, not physical. Specifically, my otaku's obsessive-compulsive drive to find just the right survival gear, no matter how long it took. My online searches had taught me all about the right weapons, clothing, food, and medicine. The problem was finding them in an apartment complex of urban Sararima. I made quite a sight, shimmying down that sheet rope in a businessman's raincoat and Reiko's bright pink vintage Hello Kitty school bag. It had taken a long time, but by the third day, I had almost everything I needed. Everything except a reliable weapon.
There wasn't anything?
This was not America, where there used to be more firearms than people. True fact. An otaku in Kobe hacked this information directly from your National Rifle Association.
I meant a hand tool, a hammer, a crowbar.
What Sarariman does his own home maintenance? I thought of a golf club. There were many of those, but I saw what the man across the way had tried to do. I did find an aluminum baseball bat, but it had seen so much action that it was too bent out of shape to be effective. I looked everywhere, believe me, but there was nothing hard or strong or sharp enough I could use to defend myself. I also reasoned that once I made it to the street, I might have better luck. A truncheon from a dead policeman, or even a soldier's firearm. Those were the thoughts that almost got me killed. I was 4 floors from the ground, almost literally, at the end of my rope. Each section I made extended for several floors, just enough length to allow me to gather more sheets. This time I knew would be the last. By now, I had my entire escape plan worked out. Land on the 4th floor balcony, break into the apartment for a new set of sheets, I'd given up looking for a weapon by then, slide down to the sidewalk, steal the most convenient motorcycle, even though I had no idea how to ride one, streaking off like some old-timey bosozoku, and maybe even grab a girl or two along the way. My mind was barely functional by that point. If even the first part of the plan had worked and I didn't manage to make it to the ground in that state, well, what matters is that I didn't. I landed on the 4th floor balcony, reached for the sliding door, and looked up right into the face of a Xiafu. It was a young man. Mid-20s, wearing a torn suit. His nose had been bitten off, and he dragged his bloody face across the glass. I jumped back, grabbed onto my rope, and tried to climb back up. My arms wouldn't respond. No pain, no burning. I mean, they had just reached their limit. The Siafu began howling and beating his fist against the glass. In desperation, I tried to swing myself from side to side, hoping to maybe rappel against the side of the building and land on the balcony next to me. The glass shattered, and the Siafu charged for my legs. I pushed off from the building, letting go of the rope and launching myself with all my might. And I missed. The only reason we are speaking now is that my diagonal fall carried me onto the balcony below my target. I landed on my feet, stumbled forward, and almost went toppling off the other side. I stumbled into the apartment and immediately looked around for any Siafu. The living room was empty. The only piece of furniture, a small traditional table propped up against the door. The occupant must have committed suicide like the others. I didn't smell anything foul, so I guess he must have thrown himself out of the window. I reasoned that I was alone. And just this small measure of relief was enough to cause my legs to give out from under me. I slumped against the living room wall, almost delirious with fatigue. I found myself looking at a collection of photographs decorating the opposite wall. The apartment's owner had been an old man, and the photographs told of a very rich life. He'd had a large family, many friends, and have traveled to what seemed every exciting and exotic locale around the world. I never imagined leaving my bedroom, let alone even leading that kind of life. I promised myself that if I ever made it out of this nightmare, I wouldn't just survive. I would live. My eyes fell on the only other item in the room, a kamidana, or traditional Shinto shrine. Something was on the floor beneath it. I guess a suicide note. The wind must have blown it off when I entered. I didn't feel right just leaving it there. I hobbled across the room and stooped to pick it up. Many kamidana have a small mirror in the center. My eye caught a reflection in that mirror of something shambling out of the bedroom. The adrenaline kicked in just as I wheeled around. The old man was still there, the bandage on his face telling me that he must have reanimated not too long ago. He came at me. I ducked. My legs were still shaky and he managed to catch me by the hair. I twisted, trying to free myself. He pulled my face towards his. He was surprisingly fit for his age, muscle equal to, if not superior to, mine. His bones were brittle, though, and I heard them crack as I grabbed the arm that caught me. I kicked him in the chest. He flew back. His broken arm was still clutching a tuft of my hair. He knocked against the wall, photographs falling and showering him with glass. He snarled and came at me again. I backed up, tensed, then grabbed him by his one good arm. I jammed it into his back, clamped my other hand around the back of his neck, and with a roaring sound I didn't even know I could make, I shoved him, ran him right onto the balcony and over the side. He landed face up on the pavement, his head still hissing up at me from his otherwise broken body. Suddenly there was a pounding on the front door, more Siafu that had heard our scuffle. I was operating on full instinct now. I raced in the old man's bedroom and began ripping the sheets off his bed. I figured it wouldn't take too many, just three more stories and then... Then I stopped, frozen, as motionless as a photograph. That's what had caught my attention. One last photograph that was on the bare wall in his bedroom. It was black and white, grainy. It showed a traditional family. There was a mother, father, a little boy, and what I guess had to be the old man as a teenager in uniform. Something was in his hand. Something that almost stopped my heart. I bowed to the man in the photograph and said an almost tearful, "Arigato."
What was in his hand?
I found it at the bottom of a chest in his bedroom. Underneath a collection of bound papers and the ragged remains of the uniform from the photo. The scabbard was green, chipped, army-issue aluminum, and an improvised leather grip had replaced the original shark skin. but the steel. Bright like silver and folded, not machine stamped. A shallow tori curvature with a long straight point. Flat wide ridge lines, decorated with the kikusui, the imperial chrysanthemum. And an authentic, not acid stained river, bordering the tempered edge. Exquisite workmanship, and clearly, forged for battle.
I motion to the sword at his side. Tatsumi smiles. Kyoto, Japan. Sensei Tomonaga Ichiro knows exactly who I am seconds before I enter the room. Apparently I walk, smell, and even breathe like an American. The founder of Japan's Tatanokai, or Shield Society, greets me with both a bow and handshake, then invites me to sit before him like a student. Kondo Tatsumi, Tomonaga's second-in-command, serves us tea, then sits behind the old master. Tomonaga begins our interview with an apology for any discomfort I might feel about his appearance. The sensei's lifeless eyes have not functioned since his adolescence.
I am Hibakusha. I lost my sight at 11:02 a.m., August 9, 1945, by your calendar. I was standing on Mount Kumpira, manning the air raid warning station with several other boys from my class. It was overcast that day, so I heard rather than saw the B-29 passing close overhead. It was only a single B-San, probably a reconnaissance flight, and not even worth reporting. I almost laughed when my classmates jumped into our slit trench. I kept my eyes fixed above the Urakami Valley, hoping to maybe catch a glimpse of the American bomber. Instead, all I saw, the last thing I would ever see, was the flash. In Japan, Hibakusha, survivors of the bomb, occupied a unique rung in our nation's social ladder. We were treated with sympathy and sorrow, victims and heroes and symbols for every political agenda. And yet, as human beings, we were little more than social outcasts. No family would allow their child to marry us. Hibakusha were unclean, blood in Japan's otherwise pristine genetic onsen. I felt this shame on a deeply personal level. Not only was I Hibakusha, but my blindness also made me a burden. From the sanatorium's windows, I could hear the sounds of our nation struggling to rebuild itself. And what was my contribution to this effort? Nothing! So many times I tried inquiring about some manner of employment, some work, no matter how small or demeaning. No one would have me. I was still Hibakusha, and I learned so many polite ways to be rejected. My brother begged me to come and stay with him, insisting that he and his wife would take care of me and even find some useful task around the house. For me, that was even worse than the sanatorium. He had just gotten back from the army and they were trying to have another baby. To impose on them at such a time was unthinkable. Of course, I considered ending my own life. I even attempted it on many occasions. Something prevented me, staying my hand each time I reached for the pills or broken glass. I reasoned it was weakness. What else could it be? A Hibakusha, a parasite, and now a dishonorable coward. There was no end to my shame in those days. As the emperor had said in his surrender speech to our people, I was truly enduring the unendurable. I left the sanatorium without informing my brother. I didn't know where I was heading, only that I had to get as far from my life, my memories, myself, as possible. I traveled, begged mostly. I had no more honor to lose, until I settled in Sapporo on the island of Hokkaido. This cold northern wilderness has always been Japan's least populated prefecture, and with the loss of Sakhalin and the Kuriles, it became, as the Western saying goes, the end of the line. In Sapporo, I met an Ainu gardener, Ota Hideki. The Ainu are Japan's oldest indigenous group and even lower on our social ladder than the Koreans. Maybe that is why he took pity on me, another pariah cast out by the tribe of Yamato. Maybe it was because he had no one to pass his skills or knowledge along to. His own son had never returned from Manchuria. Ota-san worked at the Akakaze, a former luxury hotel that now served as a repatriation center for Japanese settlers from China. At first, the administration complained that they had no more funds to hire another gardener. Ota-san paid me out of his own pocket. He was my teacher and my only friend, and when he died, I considered following him. But coward that I was, I could not bring myself to do it. Instead, I simply continued to exist, working silently in the earth as the Akakaze went from a repatriation center to a luxury hotel, and Japan went from conquered rubble to economic superpower. I was still working at the Akakaze when I heard of the first domestic outbreak. I was trimming the Western-style hedges near the restaurant when I overheard several of the guests discussing the Nagumo murders. According to their conversation, a man had slain his wife, then set upon the corpse like some kind of wild dog. This was the first time I had heard the term African rabies. I tried to ignore it, tried to get on with my work. But the next day there were more conversations, more hushed voices across the lawn and beside the pool. Nagumo was old news compared to the much more serious outbreak at Sumitomo Hospital in Osaka. And the next day there was Nagoya, then Sendai, then Kyoto. I tried to push their conversations from my mind. I had come to Hokkaido to escape from the world, to live out my days in shame and ignominy. The voice that finally convinced me of danger came from the hotel's manager, a stiff, no-nonsense salaryman with a very formal manner of speech. After the outbreak in Hirosaki, he held a staff meeting to try and debunk, once and for all, these wild rumors about dead bodies coming back to life. I had only his voice to rely on, and you can tell everything about a person by what happens when he opens his mouth. Mr. Sugawara was pronouncing his words far too carefully, particularly his hard, sharp consonants. He was overcompensating for a previously conquered speech impediment, a condition that only threatened to rise in the presence of great, uncontrollable anxiety. I had listened to this verbal defense mechanism before, from the seemingly unflappable Sugawara-san, first during the 95 quake, and again in 98 when North Korea had sent a long-range, nuclear-capable test missile streaking over our homeland. Sugawara-san's articulation had been almost imperceptible then. Now it shrieked louder than the air raid sirens of my youth. And so, for the second time in my life, I ran. I considered warning my brother, calling him, writing him, but so much time had passed, I had no idea how to reach him, or even if he was still alive. That was the last, and probably the greatest of all my dishonorable acts, the heaviest weight I will carry to my grave.
Why did you run? Were you afraid for your life?
Of course not. If anything, I welcomed it. To die, to finally be put out of my lifelong misery, was almost too good to be true. What I feared was once again becoming a burden to those around me. To slow someone down, to take up valuable space, to put other lives in danger if they tried to save an old blind man who wasn't worth saving. And what if those rumors about the dead returning to life were true? What if I were to find myself infected and awake from death to threaten the lives of my fellow countrymen? No, that was not going to be the fate of this disgraced Hibakusha. If I was to meet my death, it should be in the same manner as I had lived my life. Forgotten, isolated, and alone. I left at night and began hitchhiking south down Hokkaido's DOO expressway. All I had with me was a water bottle, a change of clothes, and my ikupasai, a long flat shovel similar to a Shaolin spade, but which also served for many years as my walking stick. There was still a sizable amount of road traffic in those days. Our oil from Indonesia and the Gulf was still flowing, and many truck drivers and private motorists were kind enough to give me a ride. With each and every one, our conversation turned to the crisis. Did you hear that the self-defense force has been mobilized? The government's going to have to declare a state of emergency. Did you hear there was an outbreak last night right here in Sapporo? No one was sure what the next day would bring, how far the calamity would spread, or who would be its next victim. And yet, no matter whom I spoke to or how terrified they sounded, each conversation would inevitably end with, "But I'm sure the authorities will tell us what to do." One truck driver said, "Any day now you'll see, if you just wait patiently and don't make a public fuss." That was the last human voice I heard, the day before I left civilization and trekked into the Hidaka Mountains. I was very familiar with this national park. Ota-san had taken me here every year to collect sansai, the wild vegetables that attract botanists, hikers, and gourmet chefs from all over the home islands. As a man who rises in the middle of the night knows the exact location of every item in his darkened bedroom, I knew every river and every rock, every tree and patch of moss. I even knew every onsen that bubbled to the surface, and therefore never wanted for a naturally hot and cleansing mineral bath. Every day I told myself, "This is the perfect place to die. Soon I will have an accident, a fall of some kind. Or perhaps I will become ill, contract some sickness or eat a poisoned root. Or maybe I will finally do the honorable thing and just stop eating altogether." And yet, every day, I foraged and bathed, dressed warmly and minded my steps. As much as I longed for death, I continued to take whatever measures necessary to prevent it. I had no way of knowing what was happening to the rest of my country. I could hear distant sounds, helicopters, fighter planes, the steady high-altitude whine of civilian jetliners. Perhaps I was wrong, I thought. Perhaps the crisis was over. For all I knew, the authorities had been victorious, and the danger was rapidly fading into memory. Perhaps my alarmist departure had done nothing more than create a welcome job opening back at the Akakaze, and perhaps one morning I would be roused by the barking voices of angry park rangers, or the giggles and whispers of schoolchildren on a nature hike. Something did arouse me from my sleep one morning, but not a collection of giggling students. And no, it wasn't one of them either. It was a bear, one of the many large brown higuma roaming the Hokkaido wilderness. The higuma had originally migrated from the Kamchatka Peninsula and bore the same ferocity and raw power of their Siberian cousins. This one was enormous. I could tell by the pitch and resonance of his breathing. I judged him to be at least 2 meters tall and no more than 4 or 5 meters from me. I rose slowly and without fear. Next to me lay my ikupasai. It was the closest thing I had to a weapon, and I suppose if I had thought to use it as such, it might have made a formidable defense.
You didn't use it.
Nor did I want it. This animal was much more than just a random hungry predator. This was fate, I believed. This encounter could only be the will of the kami.
Who is kami?
What is kami? The kami are the spirits that inhabit each and every facet of our existence. We pray to them, honor them, hope to please them and curry their favor. They are the same spirits that drive Japanese corporations to bless the site of a soon-to-be-constructed factory, and the Japanese of my generation to worship the emperor as a god. The kami are the foundation of Shinto, literally the way of the gods, and worship of nature is one of its oldest and most sacred principles. That is why I believed their will was at work that day. By exiling myself into the wilderness, I had polluted nature's purity. After dishonoring myself, my family, my country, I had at last taken that final step and dishonored the gods. Now they had sent an assassin to do what I had been unable to for so long, to erase my stink. I thanked the gods for their mercy. I wept as I prepared myself for the blow. It never came. The bear stopped panting, then released a high, almost childlike whimper. "What is wrong with you?" I actually said to a 300-kilogram carnivore. "Go on and finish me." The bear continued to whine like a frightened dog, then tore away from me with the speed of hunted prey. It was then that I heard the moan. I spun, tried to focus my ears. From the height of his mouth, I could tell he was taller than me. I heard one foot dragging across the soft, moist earth and air bubbling from a gaping wound in its chest. I could hear it reaching out to me, groaning and swiping at empty air. I managed to dodge its clumsy attempt and snatched up my ikupasai. I centered my attack on the source of the creature's moan. I struck quickly, and the crack vibrated up through my arms. The creature fell back upon the earth as I released a triumphant shout of 10,000 years. It is difficult for me to describe my feelings at this moment. Fury had exploded within my heart, a strength and courage that drove away my shame as the sun drives the night from heaven. I suddenly knew the gods had favored me. The bear hadn't been sent to kill me. It had been sent to warn me. I didn't understand the reason right then, but I knew I had to survive until the day when that reason was finally revealed. And that is what I did for the next few months. I survived. I mentally divided the Hidaka range into a series of several hundred chitai. Each chitai contained some object of physical security, a tree or tall flat rock, some place I could sleep in peace without the danger of immediate attack. I slept always during the day and only traveled, foraged, or hunted at night. I did not know if the beasts depended on their sight as much as human beings, but I wasn't going to give them even the most infinitesimal advantage. Losing my vision had also prepared me for the act of ever-vigilant mobility. Those with sight have a tendency to take walking for granted. How else could they trip over something they've clearly seen? The fault lies not in the eyes, but in the mind. A lazy thought process spoiled by a lifetime of optic nerve dependency. Not so for those like me. I already had to be on guard for potential danger, to be focused, alert, and watching my step, so to speak. Simply adding one more threat was no bother at all. Every time I walked, it was for no longer than several hundred paces. I would halt, listen to and smell the wind, perhaps even press my ear to the ground. This method never failed me. I was never surprised, never caught off guard. I would hear the moan wafting across the hills and fields and know that, in perhaps a half an hour or so, one of the living dead would be paying me a visit. In instances such as these, I would stop dead in my tracks and patiently prepare myself for the attack. I would unclasp my pack, stretch my limbs, sometimes just find a place to sit quietly and meditate. I always knew when they were getting close enough to strike. I always took the time to bow and thank them for being so courteous to warn me. I almost felt sorry for the poor mindless filth, to come all this way slowly and methodically, only to end their journey with a split skull or severed neck.
Did you always kill your enemy on the first strike?
Always.
He gestures with an imaginary ikupusai.
Thrust forward, never swing. At first I would aim for the base of the neck. Later, as my skills grew with time and experience, I learned to strike here.
He places his hand horizontally against the indentation between the forehead and the nose.
It was a little harder than simple decapitation, all that thick, tough bone. But it did serve to destroy the brain, as opposed to decapitation, where the living head would always require a secondary blow.
What about multiple attackers? Was that more of a problem?
Yes, in the beginning. As their number swelled, I began to find myself increasingly surrounded. Those early battles were untidy. I must admit I allowed my emotions to rule my hand. I was the typhoon, not the lightning bolt. During one melee at Tokachidake, I dispatched 41 in as many minutes. I was washing bodily fluids from my clothes for a fortnight. Later, as I began to exercise more tactical creativity, I allowed the gods to join me on the battlefield. I would lead groups of beasts to the base of a tall rock, where I would crush their skulls from above. I might even find a rock that allowed them to climb up after me, not all at once, you understand. One by one, so I could knock them back into the jagged outcroppings below. I was sure to thank the spirit of each rock or cliff or waterfall that carried them over 1,000-meter drops. This last incident was not something I cared to make a habit of. It was a long and arduous climb to retrieve the body.
You went after the corpse?
To bury it. I couldn't just leave it there, desecrating the stream. It would not have been proper.
Did you retrieve all the bodies?
Every last one. That time after Tokachidake, I dug for 3 days. The heads I always separated. Most of the time I just burned them. But at Tokachidake, I threw them into the volcanic crater where Oyamatsumi's rage could purge their stench. I did not completely understand why I committed these acts. It just felt correct to separate the source of the evil. Like any garden, Japan could not be allowed to wither and die. We would care for her. We would preserve her. We would annihilate the walking blight that infested and defiled her. And we would restore her beauty and purity for the day when her children would return to her.
Just a few civilians against 1 million zombies?
I might be facing 50 million monsters, but those monsters would be facing the gods.
Cienfuegos, Cuba. Seriosha Garcia Alvarez suggests I meet him at his office. The view is breathtaking, he promises. You will not be disappointed. On the 69th floor of the Malpica Savings and Loans Building, the second tallest building in Cuba after Havana's Jose Marti Towers, Señor Alvarez's corner office overlooks both the glittering metropolis and bustling harbor below. It is the magic hour for energy-independent buildings like the Malpica, that time of the day when its photovoltaic windows capture the setting sun with their almost imperceptible magenta hue. Señor Alvarez was right. I am not disappointed.
Cuba won the zombie war. Maybe that's not the most humble of statements given what happened to so many other countries, but just look at where we were 20 years ago as opposed to where we are now. Before the war, we lived in a state of quasi-isolation, worse than during the height of the Cold War. At least in my father's day, you could count on what amounted to economic welfare from the Soviet Union and their Comecon puppets. Since the fall of the communist bloc, though, our existence was one of constant deprivation. Ration food, ration fuel. The closest comparison I can make is that of Great Britain during the Blitz. And like that other besieged island, we too lived under the dark cloud of an ever-present enemy. The U.S. blockade, while not as constricting as during the Cold War, nonetheless sought to suffocate our economic lifeblood by punishing any nation that attempted free and open trade. As successful as the U.S. strategy was, its most resounding triumph was allowing Fidel to use our northern oppressor as an excuse to remain in power. "You see how hard your life is," he would say. "The blockade has done this to you. The Yankees have done this to you. And without me, they would be storming our beaches even now." He was brilliant. Machiavelli's most favorite son. He knew we would never remove him while the enemy was at the gates. And so we endured the hardships and the oppression, the long lines and the hushed voices. This was the Cuba I grew up in, the only Cuba I could ever imagine. That is, until the dead began to rise. Cases were small and immediately contained, mostly Chinese refugees and a few European businessmen. Travel from the United States was still largely prohibited, so we were spared the initial blow of the first wave mass migration. The repressive nature of our fortress society allowed the government to take steps to ensure that the infection was never allowed to spread. All internal travel was suspended. And both the regular army and the territorial militias were mobilized. Because Cuba had such a high percentage of doctors per capita, our leader knew the true nature of the infection weeks after the first outbreak was reported. By the time of the Great Panic, when the world finally woke up to the nightmare, breaking down their doors, Cuba had already prepared itself for war. The simple fact of geography spared us the danger of large-scale overland swarms. Our invaders came from the sea, specifically from an armada of boat people.